From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Michelle Norris. It's been a long week on Wall Street. Stocks fell for a fourth day in a row on continued signs of a sluggish economy. President Obama and others have said the U.S. must boost its exports to turn things around.
We're tired of just buying from everybody else. We want to start selling to other people.
Well, here's one American industry that's managing to do more of that: dairy. Kirk Siegler of member station KUNC takes us to one farm north of Denver to see how it's faring.
What do these cows on this dairy farm in northeast Colorado have to do with China? More than you'd think.
1 out of 10 gallons of milk that I produce is consumed by not only someone I don't know, but someone that lives in a country that I haven't, most likely, have not been to.
Cows at Les Hardesty's Painted Prairie Farms churn out milk that will be drunk locally, made into cheese and sold in the region, or increasingly dehydrated into powder and shipped and sold abroad.
And my farmer math will tell you that 95% of the people live someplace other than the United States. As their income increases, they too want the Western diet.
Now, this all started happening a couple of years ago when Hardesty says the dairy industry decided to ramp up exports. Farms across the country were getting so big, and some say too big, that all the milk couldn't possibly be consumed domestically.
And it just made sense. The world economy was strong. People wanted U.S. dairy proteins.
It made sense until the global economic crash. Americans bought less milk, but Mexicans also demanded less dehydrated milk, China less whey protein and pizza cheese. But here's where the dairy business can be different than others who export. Hardesty can't just stop milking all these cows and turn off these efficient, automated, and expensive milking machines.
A different business might be able to lay people off. Here we deal with animals, weather, on a daily basis, and so we have to have the people and the resources to do that.
And so Hardesty spent much of the recession burning equity and borrowing money to keep the farm afloat. It's a familiar story, says Scott Brown. He's an economist at the University of Missouri's Food and Ag Policy Research Institute.
I think the United States dairy industry has figured out that playing in world markets, although it can have some very good benefits, certainly can only add to the volatility that the industry's faced the last few years.
But there are some positive signs. Buried in this week's sour economic news that U.S. exports continue to slip are numbers showing that U.S. dairy exports actually increased, if slightly, by 3%. Yet Brown says nobody's celebrating.
We came out of 2009 in the worst financial situation many of them have probably ever faced in their lifetime.
And Brown says despite the blip, there are signs that dairy exports could drop off again later this year as Australia and New Zealand ramp up production again. As for Les Hardesty, this spring he became the chairman of the U.S. Dairy Export Council. And he believes expanding the dairy export market now is key for his industry's long-term survival.
The world economy is slow to recover, but it will. And when it does, we need to be positioned to fill those needs.
Agriculture officials in the Obama administration say they're aware of this, and efforts are underway to expedite long-pending free trade agreements with Asian and Central American countries. For NPR News, I'm Kirk Siegler.
Some prominent liberals are calling on Congress to approve more stimulus spending to revive the economy. Many conservatives say no, it'd be much better for Congress to make all the tax cuts from the Bush era permanent. Adam Davidson of NPR's Planet Money team says the real economic stimulus won't come from Congress. It's already happening at the Fed, and most people probably aren't aware of it.
The academic debate over whether fiscal stimulus is our only salvation or the worst idea that anyone ever came up with, that debate does not matter, because here's just about the easiest prediction someone can make. A fiscal stimulus is not going to happen. There is almost no possible way the Democrats in Congress would go into a tough election by borrowing nearly a trillion more bucks. A second massive stimulus, if it was even thought about, it would be on the front page of every paper. It would lead the nightly news. You'd hear about it on every cable chat show. So imagine how surprising it was that this very week, although there's a good chance you didn't notice, the Federal Reserve did something awfully close to announcing a huge new stimulus. In the height of the crisis, back in January 2009, the Fed started to buy mortgages, a lot of mortgages, $1.25 trillion in mortgage-backed securities. there is a decent chance that the Fed effectively owns your house. The Fed doesn't normally muck about in people's homes. The goal was something called monetary stimulus, but its effect is the same as fiscal stimulus, the kind passed by Congress. They basically have the same idea: get lots more money out into the economy. The Fed plan was to hold those mortgages for a short time and then sell them as quickly as possible. This week, the Fed made a major shift in policy. They said not so fast. Technically, what they're doing is transferring some of the $1.25 trillion from mortgage securities to other types of securities, but the impact is largely the same. Our economy is going to be pushed forward, although maybe not terribly effectively, by a massive monetary stimulus from the central bank. The Fed knows, of course, that most people pay very little attention to Fed announcements. Fed stimulus? That's a snooze on the business pages. Congressional stimulus? You hear people screaming about it all day long on cable news and on radio talk shows. Now, this may be exactly how things are supposed to work. The whole idea of a central bank is to have a group of serious, economically trained folks who are not constantly worried about the next election. And many outside experts do support what the Fed is doing. But it does seem a bit strange that such an important decision received so little attention. Adam Davidson, NPR News.
This year, NPR, along with the Public Radio Exchange, has launched a new show, State of the Reunion, with host Al Letson. State of the Reunion has been traveling the country, visiting cities and towns to explore the idea of community. One stop, small town of Oak Ridge in the southern Cascade Mountains of Oregon. For decades after World War II, Oak Ridge was a booming lumber town, but by the early 1990s, the lumber industry had collapsed, and Oak Ridge has struggled ever since, losing families and businesses. Now, as Al Letson discovered, residents are trying to reinvent the place as a playground for outdoor enthusiasts.
There's a short climb, so you want to gear down right here.
Okay.
I'm doing my best to avoid a faceplant and keep up with mountain biking entrepreneur Randy Dryling. We're negotiating the wet rocks and roots along Salmon Creek Trail.
This is considered the easiest trail around, by the way.
I appreciate you taking me on the easy one.
No problem.
Salmon Creek is a part of some 350 miles of trails that has earned Oak Ridge the self-proclaimed title of mountain biking capital of the Northwest. This place is lush, damp, green, and spectacular, with clouds that cling like cotton balls to the wooded mountainsides. Randy Dryling, who owns Oregon Adventures Mountain Biking Touring, hopes to help spark an economic rejuvenation for the town.
Mountain biking's a piece of the pie. It's not the end-all be-all, but it's what we got. And it's been good to us, and anybody that's being honest to themselves can see the amount of people that mountain biking's bringing to town more and more every year.
But not everyone here is on board with the change in focus. Oak Ridge is home to old-timers like Eddie Roberts, who made his living off the old-growth lumber that once abounded here. There are a lot of economic factors at play, but the death knell for the lumber industry came in 1990. That's when the federal government listed the spotted owl as a threatened species and declared much of its habitat in the national forest off-limits to loggers.
That spotted owl could care less where he lives. I've seen him out on a fence post, out in a farmer's field down the valley.
Eddie Roberts sees the mostly younger newcomers to Oak Ridge as an extension of the folks who moved into the town in the 60s, many of them from the college town of Eugene, about 50 miles away.
We called it Eugene the hippie town, but there was a mess of them, and we got them yet today. They're members of the Sierra Club. They're in our politics today, and they don't want any timber logged.
To understand that kind of bitterness, you've got to go back and remember what Oak Ridge was like in the logging boom times. That was before Main Street was filled with shuttered and abandoned buildings, the poverty and unemployment rates soared, and the population declined. It was a time when the Pope and Talbot Mill was running multiple shifts, and the town was jumping.
We had four or five service stations. We had a furniture store, appliance center,
three car dealerships, and we had clothing stores. And at that time, you couldn't find a place here to rent. The town was just
more taverns than
alive.
Churches. Kind of like the Wild West here for a while, you know? Go to any tavern, you're bound to see a fight during those days.
That was Eddie Roberts, followed by longtime residents Sharon Baker and Steve Marcot. After the collapse of the industry, Marco clung to logging as long as he could. But for the last 7 years, each weekday morning, he's driven from his cramped apartment to work in an ice cream factory in Eugene.
I don't like my job right now so much. I work at 4:30 and start making ice cream. And then get off at 1:30 and home at 2:30. Relax for about 3 or 4 hours and go to bed by about 7:30, 8 o'clock and do it over again.
Today, 57-year-old Marco's gray-streaked hair reaches the middle of his back. He's added some weight to his lumberjack frame, but he still yearns for his days in the woods.
What I've done differently, I would have probably gotten more into learning some machinery, gotten in less fights. Probably would have been a better husband. I wouldn't have lost my wife and kids. But yeah, I'd done things different, but I'd still do it again. Even if I knew it wasn't going to be any different, I'd do it again. I liked it. I had fun.
But Marco says he makes a decent salary and finds himself in a better position than many Oak Ridge residents.
All right. Peanut butter?
Yes, please.
Spaghetti sauce? Tomato sauce or canned tomatoes?
About 1,600 people a month come here to the Oak Ridge Food Bank to pick up free supplies. Okay. That's about half the town's population.
Chicken noodle and a tomato and bean soup.
Chicken noodle.
Just outside the food box, as it's called, we ran into Cameron Nelson with a cart full of groceries and four scrambling young children. She's a stay-at-home mom, and her husband is an out-of-work painter's assistant. Things are tough these days.
If it weren't for this food box, it would make it difficult here. It fills in the gaps. It allows us to utilize the close to expired or expired items, which don't hurt you. They're just taken off the shelf at the stores, and it helps stretch the money throughout the month. Stay close, babies.
5 years ago, Cameron and her family relocated to Oak Ridge for its natural beauty. And many retirees have been attracted to the area's bucolic life as well. But Oak Ridge has also proved a magnet for other reasons.
My name is Shelley Miller. I am the coordinator for the Oak Ridge Westphal Family Resource Center.
Shelley Miller, who barely keeps her own head above water economically, works long hours helping the poor of Oak Ridge and neighboring Westphal. Among her many duties is coordinating a washer-dry giveaway program where donated machines are provided to low-income families. It's a necessity since the area's only laundromat closed last fall. Miller says out-of-work people have been steered towards her town because it's more than 35 miles from an employment center, and they don't have to look for work every week to justify continuing getting their unemployment and welfare checks.
It was said, you know, go up to Oak Ridge, the rent's cheap, you can't look for a job, there are no jobs. And, you know, you get food stamps, and so you can live pretty good there. So as our stronger families had to leave because they'd lost their job, their mill job, and so they moved on to either retraining or whatever, then what was left was pretty poor.
Hard times aside, Shelley Miller says she can feel something exciting percolating in the town.
We still have a lot of very strong people who have lived here for 70 years, and they're not so happy with some of the change, but I see that their children may leave in the 20s, but they come back in the 30s to raise their children, and that shows, I think, a lot. So I think it's going to change and be for the better. A lot of people are buying the houses and fixing them up, so the neighborhood's starting to look a little bit better.
One place that's looking better is what used to be the rough and smoky Breaktime Tavern on First Street.
You going for a pint there, sir, or are you after a half?
A half, please.
I'll go for a half.
Today, the place has been converted into a proper British-like pub. The Brewers Union Local 18 serves its own blend of cask beers and ales, and it functions as kind of a town den, hosting community meetings and Scrabble night.
Oh, look at this. Look what I got.
Down on Route 58, East Coast transplants Greg Spoon and Becky Chamberlain opened the Trailhead Cafe 7 years ago to cater to mountain bikers. But now it attracts a cross-section of the community. Greg and Becky say it took a while to gain acceptance.
The old paradigm is the loggers paradigm, which is locals only. We don't want people coming, moving here. This is our area. But the logging stopped, and that idea still stuck.
In the last few years, there's definitely been this very exciting growth that's been happening here. You know, I felt very alone for a long time, and now it's like, oh, look at these other... Maybe our job to inspire other people to do something and do something positive here create something here is finally paying off, because now there are flower shops and bakeries and a pub and beautiful massage practice.
This is a gorgeous trail right here, but this doesn't even rank in my top 10 trails in the area. Hey, we're gonna drop down and go back up quick. Careful.
Back, riding among the 700-year-old trees along the Salmon Creek Trail with Randy Dryly, even a non-biking city slicker like me can feel the attraction of the place.
Sorry. Woo! That root caught me.
Out on the trail, a friend of Randy's told us about a retiring foresterman who wrote a letter to the community. And in it, he noted that many of the former loggers have now bought mountain bikes, and the mountain bikers, who want to keep the trails maintained, have bought chainsaws. For NPR News, I'm Al Edson.
Our story was produced by Peter Breslow, and you can hear State of the Reunion's full hour on Oak Ridge on many NPR stations. You can find a link to that program and more on Oak Ridge at our website, npr.org. Listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. More signs this week that the sluggish economy is persisting. Friday brought news that consumer spending is flat. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 400 points for the week. On Thursday, the Labor Department reported the number of people filing for unemployment benefits for the first time went up last week. What can we tell from these trends? Will the nation's economy keep lurching slowly forward, or will it slip backward and lead to a double-dip recession? We're joined now by Professor Danny Boston of Georgia Tech. In addition to teaching there, he runs the Gazelle Index that analyzes the nation's fastest-growing African-American-owned businesses. Professor Boston, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Scott.
Double-dip recession, to emphasize again, is when the economy improves for a period of two and then falls back. Many banks and major companies are doing well, so why aren't they hiring?
What corporations did was to take advantage of the downturn to undertake an enormous downsize in their workforce. Mm-hmm. And that was in response to global competition. So some of the dynamics that we see in the labor market today actually are in response to events that have been taking place for the last 10 to 15 years. As a result, now what they're doing is keeping the workforce that they have, investing a lot in technology, and trying to meet the same or new levels of output with the same workforce. And so you're getting increased profitability, no new hiring.
Mm-hmm. When we say that the unemployment rate is almost 10% in this country, that leaves people with an idea that one out of every 10 people don't have a job. But I wonder, in some communities, among some groups of people in this country, is that perception of 1 in 10, if it's not a lot higher?
It is. It's significantly higher. For example, African Americans, that unemployment rate is near 16%, mm-hmm. and it's been persistently high. Among Hispanics, it's around 13%. So that rate is high, and it's almost, if we were speaking of the country as a whole with rates that minorities such as African Americans and Hispanics are currently experiencing, we would say, well, the country is in near depression state.
We mentioned you have a specialty in analyzing small businesses. What's the good news, bad news there?
When we went through the recession from 2007 and into 2008, what we saw is that 85% of all of the net new employment was being created by businesses with 50 or fewer workers. So those small businesses are very, very important. And part of the challenge that we're having now is that that sector is not healthy. It's not nourished as much as we would need it to be nourished in order to grow. And they're being hurt from several directions. One is they are normally linked to corporate supply chains. And, of course, as the corporate sector is cut back, their business is cut back. They do a lot of business with government sectors, particularly local governments, and the local governments are in fiscal crises.
Yeah.
And then just in order to make it through the recession, they had to rob Peter to pay Paul. And so their credit profile is pretty screwed up. And if they try to go in this new regulatory environment to borrow money, they don't have they don't stand a chance. And so they are really hurting. And unless we can do something to channel more business and capital to that sector, then it's going to make this process we're in much, much more difficult.
I'm very uncomfortable at asking an economist to make another prediction. You know all the jokes about economists making predictions. But all that being regarded, do you foresee a double dip recession?
Well, the U.S. economy is certainly strong enough and fundamentally sound enough that we should not have a double dip recession. And the only thing that I can see that would make that different is that there are some drastically adverse circumstances that would occur internationally.
Professor Danny Boston of Georgia Tech, thanks so much.
My pleasure.